785.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 785 enacts provisions of federal law relating to health insurance covered for mastectomy-related services, and we have assembled a giant packet of information for you. A lot of it is from Senator Walker. However, you do have a letter from Leonard Hagan from Blue Cross Blue Shield and additional testimony from the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Act that I think that Representative Rosenbaum and Senator Walker will talk about.
Okay, Senator Walker and Representative Rosenbaum, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to share this bill with you, Senate Bill 785. This bill actually comes to you through the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, which celebrated its 10th anniversary this year in the Capitol. Representative Rosenbaum and I are co-chairs of the Alliance, and it's a voluntary association of individuals, state agency representatives, lobbyists, community organizers, and elected officials who've been meeting since 1992 to collaborate on reform of laws affecting women. We have done many good things in our work as the Alliance, and this is one of those bills. I've provided you my written testimony, and I'm just going to sort of highlight that because I really hate it when people come in front of my committee and read their testimony. So I'm just going to highlight it. I can tell you that this bill is one of the most interesting bills I've worked on this session. We start out big and end up small, but the small changes that we're proposing are really quite remarkable, and I think it will meet the needs of those in our state who are diagnosed with breast cancer. I have in front of you, below my testimony, you should have a copy of the text of the Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act of 1998, which was signed into law by President Clinton. It's known as by the acronym of WICRA, and so I'll refer to that. Essentially, what the act does is provide for reconstruction of the affected breast with a diagnosis of breast cancer and need for a mastectomy, reconstruction of the other breast to produce a symmetrical appearance, a prosthesis or implants, and treatment for complications, physical complications of a mastectomy. It also requires an insurance company to provide notice to its members that this provision is available to them. Oregon adopted the act by reference in 1999, and it applies to group and individual plans as well as the self-insured, because the federal government has jurisdiction over the self-insured, unlike the state does. It's important for you to know that WICRA did not mandate coverage of mastectomy in the first instance with any insurance company. It only says that if you provide mastectomy coverage, you have to meet these requirements of the federal act. So you might be sitting there asking yourselves, and why do we need Senate Bill 785? And that is why this bill was so difficult for me to get my hands around. When I took over this bill, we did a study, conducted a study in my office of the major insurance carriers, and we started calling them, and that's when we found out about the Federal Women's Health and Wellness, Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act. We also learned that there are problems in Oregon resulting from that. And so Senate Bill 785 is an attempt to clarify what federal law does, and it actually tightens it up and, I believe, makes it more appropriate for the men and women in Oregon who are affected by breast cancer. There are two amendments that you have before you today, and they're identical until you get to line 15 of the amendments, because when you get to lines 15 through 20 in the Dash 2 amendment, you will, if you look and line it up with the bill, you'll see that what it does is exempt the small group employers. I had a discussion with some of the lobbyists for the insurance industry last week who felt that if we're going to do anything to the WICRA, that we should make it apply to all of the insurance companies instead of just some. So I believe that's a policy decision for this committee to make, whether you accept the Dash 1s or the Dash 2s, but that is the only difference between those two, is one allows it for all insurance companies and one does not. So let me just focus my comments on the dash ones, because that's basically the crux of the bill. Under WICRA, and if you pull that out, because I'm going to be discussing that, under Section A, you'll see 1, 2, and 3, which is what is required under WICRA. Well, if you'll see that I've highlighted the provision in number 3 there that says that the coverage must be in a manner determined in consultation with the attending physician and the patient. The new provision in the Dash 1 amendment reads differently. It reads, determined by the attending physician and enrollee to be part of the enrollee's course or plan of treatment. You may see that as a distinction without a difference, but we have found in our research that some insurance companies need that provision to be clarified, because we still find that some companies are not paying attention to the decision made between a woman and her doctor. And U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is co-chief sponsor of WICRA, indicates on her website, and I'm going to quote that for the record, the Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act will force insurance companies to leave medical decision-making to doctors and their patients. It is long past time for Congress to send a strong message to insurance companies. Medical decisions must be made by medical professionals, not anonymous insurance clerks. Now, it's easiest for us to beat up on the big bad insurance companies. We frequently do that here. They serve a purpose, but they also sometimes need guidance, and I believe that this bill would provide that. You have a letter also in your packet from Ms. Amy Hanlon that addresses this issue. Ms. Hanlon cannot be with us today because her cancer has relapsed. She's in treatment and is not allowed to be out in the general public for 3 weeks after her treatment. Representative Rosenbaum is here, and she will discuss Ms. Hanlon's case, as Ms. Hanlon is her constituent. The next part of the Dash 1 amendment that I wanted to talk to you about is on line 4 of the Dash 1, and it expands on WICRA in the following manner. Under WICRA, again, Section A1, it says, coverage is provided for all stages of reconstruction of the breast on which the mastectomy has been performed. The Dash 1s would enhance that provision by continuing on with that sentence and stating, including but not limited to nipple, areola, complex reconstruction, skin grafts, and tattooing. Again, members, Chair, we find this provision is necessary because in our survey and our discussions, it led us to Dr. Douglas Berry's office, a plastic surgeon in Eugene who treats a lot of women with breast cancer and some men. One of their patients had to pay out of pocket for nipple reconstruction and tattooing because the insurance company deemed it not medically necessary. And I had hoped their office would be here to testify to that effect today, but the staff person who's responsible for that is away for a death in the family. But I suggest to you that when Congress intended that the woman's breast be reconstructed in a manner, I would suggest that they wanted that breast to be reconstructed in totality and not simply with a mound there that's inappropriate. You might wish to also read Ms. Gwen Sawyer Ostrom's letter to understand how important it is to a woman, I suspect to a man as well, but especially to a woman, to have her breast fully reconstructed. The next issue in the Dash 1s you'll find on line 8. This is probably the most, quote, radical of the proposals, and I say that facetiously because what that amendment does is require one pre-authorization for all mastectomy-related services. Again, Dr. Berry's office has experienced many problems in this regard. They work with over 20 different insurance companies, and as you can imagine, not one insurance company has the same regulations and provisions. But one thing that was consistent in a few of the companies that they work with, more than a few, is that they require pre-authorization for each step of the enrollee's course of treatment. Well, I submit to you that, as Dr. Berry's office told me, breast reconstruction can take up to a year or more. Two men or women are alike in the course of treatment. One insurance company, for instance, required that a particular procedure be done on a specific date. When the woman was unable to make the appointment because she herself was ill, the insurance company required an entirely new pre-authorization to be done. I find that to be ridiculous. I find it to be burdensome. I just don't think it's appropriate. And when the woman, the enrollee, and her physician have determined a course of treatment, there should be one seamless pre-authorization to move forward. I suggest to you that we hear cries about costs of insurance, costs of medical care, and this would be one small way that we could cut down on the cost by requiring one simple pre-authorization. Finally, on the dash one, on line 11, it requires insurance companies to expedite the review process should an enrollee's course of treatment as determined in consultation with his or her attending physician be denied. And I was handed by the gentleman from Lynn Hagen from Blue Cross Blue Shield that we actually have this provision in statutory law now, 743.857(4). Says an insurer shall expedite an enrollee's case if a provider with an established clinical relationship to the enrollee certifies in writing and provides supporting documentation that the ordinary time period for external review would seriously jeopardize the life or health of the enrollee or the enrollee's ability to regain maximum function. That became operative in 2001, and I suspect that legislative counsel just did not know about that provision. And I would certainly make reference to that provision in the bill. And I'm very appreciative that we took the foresight to pass that legislation in 2001 because certainly if there is a life or death situation, we shouldn't be waiting around for the appeals process. And indeed, Representative Rosenbaum will tell you what Ms. Hanlon's experience was in that regard. You will also note in the new provisions to WICRA offered by the Dash 1 amendments that Senate Bill 785 would be exempt from mandate review under 743-700. If we're going to tighten up WICRA, we might as well make that exempt from mandate review because I just don't think it's necessary. WICRA is never going to go away. It's a federal law. We have to comply, and we're simply expanding on that. And I recall now that there is one thing I left out in my testimony, and that was also brought to my attention by Regents Blue Cross. In the Dash 1 amendments of the bill, I ask that surgery and reconstruction of the other breast produces a completely symmetrical appearance. The insurance companies have approached me, and I've agreed to take that word completely out because that's a very subjective finding, and I'm of the conclusion, as they are, that no doctor and patient would probably be able to agree on what that means. What I was attempting to get at was a complete reconstruction, including the nipple and the tattooing, and I think we do take care of that in one of the other amendments. So that concludes my presentation. I'm certainly happy to answer some questions, and Representative Rosenbaum, I know, would like to address Ms. Hanlon and her issue.
Senator, I missed the reference in 743 sub 4. What was the, with respect to the expediting of the review, the reference you said?
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator. Mr. Chair, Senator Menes, that's 743.857 sub 4.
857 sub
4. Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you.
And I'm really pleased to know about that. I'm sure many of us weren't aware of that.
Other questions? Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Diane Rosenbaum, representing Hess District 42, and it's my great pleasure to appear for the first time this session in front of a committee chaired by one of my former Hess colleagues and sitting right next to the sponsor of the bill, one of my other House, former House colleagues. Senate Bill 785 is one of the centerpieces of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance package of bills for this legislative session, and we've provided you with a list of the organizations that comprise the Alliance. As Senator Walker said, the Alliance has existed now for 10 years. This is its 10th anniversary. It's a very broad-based group of legislators of both parties, as well as advocates on issues that concern women's health, safety, and economic well-being, and that includes organizations that span the gamut from the Oregon Student Association to the Older Women's League, the American Cancer Society, to the Food Bank, and everything in between. The issue presented in Senate Bill 785 first came before us because of a constituent of mine who had suffered from breast cancer and ran into problems getting coverage in her post-mastectomy breast reconstruction treatment. As I'm sure you're well aware, one of eight women can expect to be a victim of breast cancer at some point in her life, so there is indeed an epidemic of this disease, and though we are making progress and the survival rates are definitely much higher than they were at one time, still women have to deal with a whole range of issues, and breast reconstruction is one of those that's really the most important, most significant to a woman's recovery. My constituent, Amy Hamlin, unfortunately has suffered a relapse of her disease, and though she has been down in Salem a couple of times during the session to talk about this issue, she is undergoing chemotherapy and wasn't able to be with you today, so I want to present her testimony to you. And Amy says, I am a breast cancer survivor. I'm writing in support of Senate Bill 785. My doctors advised me to have a double mastectomy. By federal law, insurance companies that provide mastectomies are required to cover breast reconstruction. My doctor and I discussed the options that I had for breast reconstruction, and we then agreed on what the best procedure for me would be. The procedure my doctor and I agreed on was not offered by my HMO, and we were denied. I appealed and was again denied. My HMO then informed me that they needed more time to do a literature review. My HMO refused to refer me to a doctor who could perform this procedure. I also learned that the procedure I wanted was offered by my HMO for its patients in California because their state law had recently changed regarding breast reconstruction. Due to my medical history, I wanted to proceed quickly with my breast reconstruction. After the literature review, the HMO claimed that the procedure I wanted was comparable to another procedure. They made this claim even though there is much research that states that the procedures are not comparable. Unless laws are changed, there is no motivation for the insurance companies to alter what they deem to be the standard of care. When women are going through the physical and emotional trauma of cancer and mastectomies, they should not have to deal with additional trauma. They should not have to battle their HMOs. They should not have to worry if they will have a compromised life or future surgeries because of the reconstruction they were forced to accept. And she concludes, I did not get involved in this political process to promote the reconstructive approach I selected because it is not appropriate for everyone, and that is precisely the point. The women and men of Oregon need a breast cancer, breast reconstruction bill that allows the decisions regarding the type of breast reconstruction to be determined by the physician and the patient based on the best practice for that individual and not based upon what the HMO's version of the standard of care dictates. It seems a simple matter that the determining factor in getting treatment in this very serious disease should be that women and their doctors are able to select the best option for treatment, and then that should be the treatment that's provided. That did not happen in the case of my constituent. She did, in fact, end up going out of state to get the treatment that her doctor had recommended for her, and she ended up paying out of pocket and is still in an appeal process to try to get that treatment covered by her insurance company. But I really think that this bill is something that would alleviate these situations from happening to other people in Oregon at a time of crisis when they're really ill-equipped to be fighting over insurance coverage. I think it would do a lot of good for a lot of people in Oregon, and I would urge the committee to act favorably on Senate Bill 785. I also want to thank Senator Walker for taking this issue on and doing the yeoman's work at preparing the amendments. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions. The California statute, is this bill patterned after California?
Many features of it are, although we did end up, as we delved further into it, finding that there were some provisions of Oregon law that needed to be made to conform with that language, and I think those are some things you see in the amendments that Senator Walker referred to.
And do other states have this language that you're aware of, other states?
There are several other states who have differing statutes regarding breast reconstruction. Some states had those in place before WICRA came into place, and WICRA is intended to act as a floor, not a ceiling, so that's why it's appropriate that we can do what we like to expand upon it and make it tight and more appropriate for Oregon.
Okay. Good questions. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Marcia Kelly. I should have had her.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. You probably know that the Women's Rights Coalition is an umbrella organization. We represent the Older Women's League of Oregon, the Salem YWCA, the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, the Oregon National Organization for Women, Delta Kappa Gamma, and the American Association of University Women. We also have individual members, and our members live in every part of the state, not just up and down I-5. Breast cancer is primarily a women's disease, though men can be affected. Once a woman is diagnosed and treatment options are given, the woman decides with her physician what options will be used. The Women's Rights Coalition feels that these decisions should include physician and patient decisions on breast cancer as well. Women should not have to go through laborious red tape at the same time they and their physician are making life-saving decisions. They should be able to know that their insurance covers reconstructive surgery to make the woman whole following surgery. The method, in doing some research, I discovered that the Methodist Healthcare System in Houston, Texas, a well-known medical facility, has on their website the following information regarding breast reconstruction. The patient is usually educated and counseled in breast reconstructive possibilities prior to mastectomy so that she can make the decision for or against reconstruction before going into surgery. Based on the personal medical history of each patient, a recommendation will be made for either immediate reconstruction performed at the same time as the mastectomy or delayed reconstruction, a second operation performed after recovery from the mastectomy is complete. There is no discussion of what the insurance company decides to authorize. Like all medical procedures, we believe the decision rests with the woman and her physician. And I have been told to clarify how many states have provisions like this, and 36 states have laws like this.
Good. Thank you.
I have also provided testimony for the American Association of University Women. The chair of the Public Policy Committee was ill today.
Going around.
Good. Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Fisher.
I don't know if you're the right person to ask this question, but I noticed that
36
objection was made to the use of the word completely. Who actually would determine?
Complete reconstruction?
No, it's not complete reconstruction. It says a completely symmetrical appearance. Now, it would seem to me that that might be just a bit complicated about what is complete appearance. Does that mean absolutely no scar showing, no differentiation whatsoever? I mean, how...
Sure. I'm not a qualified physician or surgeon, and so I would defer what in their terms completely would be. From the reading that I did, completely is a situation where there may be a need to reduce the other breast in size because they've taken so much of the one breast. Sometimes it's a need to do surgery under the arm, not just on the breast, but that's something that we feel needs to be between the physician and the woman because there are different variations of breast cancer. And I, of course, you know how serious breast cancer is in the mid-80s, and so I don't know the current statistics, but the mid-80s, I was a staff member for the American Cancer Society in this area, and more women died of breast cancer during the Vietnam War years than were killed in Vietnam.
Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to enlighten Senator Fischer on that. I had agreed to take out the word completely because it is subjective, so that word would not be in there. And if I might let you know that 36 states do have breast reconstruction laws, but they're not all the same as what we're proposing in, here in Oregon. And we did look at the California law, and it wasn't very instructive. So we did what we have before you in the Dash 1 amendments. But there are 36 states that have some various form of laws, many that were enacted prior to the federal law of 1998.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Yes. Senator Menace.
I'm somewhat confused what the bill actually does. We've got a federal act. What does this bill actually do? It's different than the federal act.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Menace, that was what was difficult for me to get my hands on, but as we, as I pointed out to you in my testimony, it does expand on the federal law. If you look at the Dash 1s, do I need to go through those again?
I guess I'm unclear which of the amendments you're proposing both include the word.
The Dash 1 and the Dash 2 are both essentially the same, other than the Dash 2 from line 15 down to line 20 is the reference to small group health employers. So you would, if you don't want to extend these provisions to those folks, then you would want to pass the Dash 2s.
Which provisions are we talking about? I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out.
All of the provisions in line 1 through 14. Oh. The changes that we are making.
1 through 14 on the amendments.
On the amendments,
right.
Yes. And then, of course, today we would also take out the word completely that you see on line 6 of the amendment. Line 6 says in line 10 of the bill, after A, insert completely. We would delete that.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you.
You're welcome. I was testifying in favor of the amendments that Senator Walker prefers after talking with people.
Okay. Thank you. Peggy Annette, would you please come up? Marty also.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annette, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. I just have a couple of comments, and I have discussed these very briefly with Senator Walker. I think the concerns that some of us had related to the word completely as well as to the expedited appeal will be taken care of. The concern that I expressed to Senator Walker was that, and it relates to what Senator Menace just asked, and that was, what's the difference between the state law and the federal law? And I understand the federal law is the floor. My concern is that when we get into duplicating or changing from the federal law and the state law, is that when you write the information up in benefit booklets, it is potentially confusing to the enrollee. An example we presently have is relates to some of the discussions about ERISA standards, which I needn't get into, but what I did agree to talk to Senator Walker about was take a look at the bill and look specifically at what the federal law requires versus what the state law requires to be sure that when the information ultimately is communicated to the insureds, that they understand and, you know, which path they want to go and how to actually get into the process and use it, because having been a person who's written too many benefit booklets, I understand that oftentimes the information that the legislature enacts, when it ultimately is translated into what the consumer receives, is not necessarily as understandable as we would all like it to be.
Questions? Thank you, Peggy. Barney Spate, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Barney Spate with Kaiser Permanente. Very briefly, I would like to endorse the amendments that Senator Walker is proposing, and particularly on line 13 of the proposed amendments, just suggest that prior to the period, perhaps inserting the words pursuant to ORS 743-857-4, which was the reference that Senator Walker made in her verbal testimony, would make that the dash one amendments, if you will, complete, because it basically ties the new subsection 4 back to the 2001 Patient Protection Act. And I would note that the Patient Protection Act, which was enacted in the 2001 legislature and is now in effect, puts in place the right of third-party review by a disinterested but scientifically-based third party, both for regular reviews regarding medical necessity and expedited reviews, as in this case. So I'm supportive of if you will, tying this legislation to that process which came out of the 2001 legislature. I would just like to add one other point, and it relates to Ms. Hanlon's testimony that was read into the record by Representative Rosenbaum. Ms. Hanlon was a member of Kaiser Permanente, and while we perhaps differ on the facts, I would point out that in our health plan, the medical necessity decisions are made by physicians. The disagreement in this case was the procedure that Ms. Hanlon requested, did it have any better medical outcome? And our reading of it was unclear. It clearly took some time, and after the fact, we've actually referred our decision processes, our medical group did, to the California medical group, and they concurred that the procedures from an evidence-based point of view had no difference in outcome. In the future, with the passage of Senate Bill 785 and its linkage to the expedited review process, that decision-making will happen in a faster time frame and will actually happen by a independent review organization. So hopefully this bill will, in fact, rectify the kinds of medical standards misunderstandings that do, in fact, occur. I just wanted to put that on the record,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Yes. Senator Minnis.
So you support the bill?
I support the bill with the amendments that are proposed by Senator Walker.
Which one?
Well, I'm looking at the dash one. I believe that, Senator, I was party to a conversation about were there advantages to making the bill apply only to, say, groups larger than 25 or 50. And from an administrative point of view, I think all of us in the industry indicated that the dash one amendments, as opposed to the dash two amendments, as amended through today's discussion, are the preferable amendments to make the bill operate in a more straightforward manner.
Senator Minnis.
Help me understand the tattooing issue.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I am not an expert in this area. From what I gathered, there may be, and I'm not actually knowledgeable about Kaiser Permanente's policies in this regard, but most insurance companies, or many insurance companies, all of the reconstruction includes the breast reconstruction and any tattooing of the areola, et cetera. There may be companies out there in the factual situation that I believe Senator Walker and her peers brought up, those may be considered to be cosmetic. I don't believe by most health insurance companies those are determined to be that, but this would clearly close that, if you will, loophole in the future to make sure that there's a uniform understanding of what breast reconstruction surgery includes in its entirety.
Mr. Chairman, I'm obviously not an expert either, but I guess I don't know what tattooing has to do with this or how it's used or if it's part of the process of reconstruction or if we're talking about tattooing some other sort. I guess I just don't know what we're talking
about. Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, as I understand it, and again, from a layman's perspective, I can certainly appreciate that in the reconstruction of a breast, there would be surgical procedures to fully restore and make the breast as normal appearance as possible, and that would include the surgical reconstruction of a nipple and the tattooing on the affected breast. That's how I understand it to mean.
Okay, but Mr. Chairman, again, not to make light of this, I actually...
Nor am I.
I actually watched a surgery on an individual's neck one time, and the physician, orthopedic surgeon, pulled out a pair of jet engine safety wire pliers, you know, which I used in the Air Force, as he ran some wire through this person's neck and safety wired it together like I would have done bolts in a jet engine in the Air Force. So I don't understand exactly whether this is a surgical procedure with another name other than tattooing, or do we bring, like, you know, some biker tattoo artist in to fix this thing up? I guess I don't know what I'm...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, as I understand it, this is part of the complete procedure that would be done by a plastic surgeon in the course of a complete breast reconstruction. That's how I believe the amendment is being interpreted by the insurance industry. It would have to be ordered by the attending physician and be deemed part of the surgical reconstruction process by the surgeon that completes it, as opposed to
Well, Mr. Chairman, that leads me to, I guess, another question. Wouldn't it be better to say, because I think we're trying to get to this discussion and dialogue between the patient and the physician, you know, any other medical procedures that this attending physician deems necessary? Or do we, if you include a word like tattooing, could that be misconstrued? In other words, you have to put my butterfly tattoo back on my breast because it's not there anymore. Or, I mean, I guess I wouldn't agree that that's necessary.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I believe the intent here, and I believe what we're trying to interpret in through this intent, that it would be, and there may be a better medical terminology for that aspect of the procedure, but I think it's intended to be procedures performed by a physician, a surgeon, in the course of reconstruction that are related to the reconstruction and not secondary to it. But
Mr. Chairman, I guess for the committee and for Senator Walker, I would assume, at least in my mind, that we use the appropriate medical terminology as opposed to words that might have other, much wider meaning. Because they mean what they mean when you write them in statute.
Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, that is the proper terminology.
Tattooing.
Yes.
Tattooing by a physician?
Yes, it's performed in the physician's office, the plastic surgeon, around the nipple area, the brown areola around the nipple. That's called tattooing when they replace that.
No, Mr. Chairman, in that respect, I would like to see this change so to make sure that is a procedure accomplished by the attending physician or a medically trained person.
You could put in the word nipple prior to tattooing to designate that it is nipple tattooing, but it's not really on the nipple.
Why don't you work out the details of this and put in the appropriate language if you need to?
I believe it is the appropriate language, but I will, upon Senator Minnis's question, examine that further and see if we can narrow that scope.
Good. Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Others wishing to testify? Okay, seeing no others, we will close the public hearing and open a public hearing on 789. Senator Shields, are you going to?
I'm here, but I am assuming that you go first or don't you go first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 789 as printed directs the Department of Human Services to establish a pilot program integrating faith-based community organizations into the provision of human services by the department. And again, that's as printed.
Okay. Senator Morris said, I can go down to the witness stand if you want me to.
That's fine. We'll call Ramona Rademacher, please.
Senator Morris said, I'd like to speak first.
Absolutely.
Is that okay? Yes. What I was going to suggest is, rather than having my back to the group, if it's okay, I'd like to stay here. That's is that okay?
Fine. Yes. Thank
I,
you. Sorry.
I kind of feel badly every time somebody out there speaks about a bill, they have to have their backs to the group. The other day, my office sent an email describing the purpose of today's hearing. And the reason for today's hearing is, bluntly, we had the hole in the calendar. Senator Morissette wanted to schedule the bill today, even though the bill that is printed, Senate Bill 789, itself is dead. That bill is not even good for amending at this point. A new bill is being developed. It's not ready yet. It's actually through Legislative Council, but it hasn't had a first reading yet. In fact, there's still some stuff in the Rules Committee, I guess, related to it. But the reason that I thought it was actually a good idea to have a hearing on the bill before you can get your hands on it is that the concept behind this bill is not easy to understand. It really isn't. And I hope that people will give me a chance this afternoon to explain fully what I intend to do with what could be called a charitable choice bill. I don't know if Senator Starr remembers this, but on the second day of the session, Senator Starr came up to me and he said something to the effect, you know, the church needs to step up and do more. And I pondered that, and a few days later, Senator Clarno actually came up to me and said the same thing. The church needs to do more. And as I thought about that and talked to other people, including Senator Minnis, I began to develop the ideas. And you have two pieces of paper in front of you. One of them on my stationery is headed Developing a Real Faith-Based Initiative. Now, it's no longer in support of 789 with amendments because we literally couldn't do amendments to that bill, so a new bill and a new number will be coming. But what I say in that paper, without reading it, I want to explain it as carefully as I can, is that during the last 7 years since the first faith-based initiatives came out during the Clinton administration and the Bush administration to follow, I don't feel that those initiatives really ever did very much other than distract faith communities and, in fact, CBOs, community-based organizations, from doing the real work of helping people in need. And by distraction, I'm not being sarcastic. I really am not. Faith-based and community-based nonprofits have missions. And in their mission statements, they'll often talk about helping the poor, helping the needy, helping the communities that they were established to help. What happened, for instance, recently, a couple years ago, was that there was a $25 million chunk of money kind of thrown out nationwide under the auspices of faith-based and community initiatives. Okay? Now, what's $25 million? $25 million is so small that it's nothing but a distraction to good people that are doing faith-based work. If you look at the Department of Human Resources for the state of Oregon, they spend billions of dollars to help the poor and the needy and so on. And you go across the country, all 50 states put together, you begin to recognize how huge an amount of money it takes to be a civilized society and to take care of people. The $25 million nationally, in my opinion, is nothing but a distraction. Good people that work most of the time taking care of the poor and the hungry and the homeless and so on, adjourned from the work they were doing to respond to RFPs. You know, that isn't the way to get the job done. Now, I think that the Bush and Clinton approaches have some place in the mix, but I still think they got it backwards. And what I'm doing with this particular charitable choice bill is try to get it right. Okay? A real faith-based organization, a real faith-based and community-based initiative, would empower organizations that are already caring for people out in the community. Now, I recognize that not everybody is part of a faith-based or a community-based organization that might be available to help them when they go into a welfare office to get a grant or whatever. I know that it's not everybody that will be affected, but many people would be affected. okay? It could help a mosque, a church, a synagogue, a community-based organization. But if you ask an average rabbi, how many people in your congregation get welfare or food stamps or services from senior and disabled services, most people would have no idea. The rabbi, the priest, the pastor, the imam, you know, whoever. And yet, collectively across the United States, the reality is that faith-based and community-based organizations have millions of people within their constituencies, people that they could be helping if they could partner with the appropriate Department of Human Services. Okay? Now, the doctrine of separation of church and state shouldn't be run over in the process. It shouldn't be minimized. Sometimes the present faith-based initiative does kind of run over it. And there's been complaints about the separation of church and state, and I'm trying to address that in what I'm doing. Instead of the state and the faith-based organizations kind of getting confused around separation of church and state, they each have separate roles and could be independent but be partners in the process. And that would happen with the state handling the people's money, whether it's the welfare grant or the food stamps or whatever. The state handles that, and the FBO or the CBO, the community-based organization, handles the nurturing, the mentoring, the networking, all of those intangible kinds of things that they're good at doing. And what you get out of this is that the state's money goes farther, okay? Because they're not just there in isolation trying to figure it out all by themselves. They have people in a network that they're already familiar with. If it's your synagogue, you're already familiar with the people in your synagogue, and now you've been networked into them, maybe they can help you find a job sooner, or help you with extra babysitting, or, you know, whatever. You might be eligible for a daycare allotment when you're on TANF, but this could expand that to a, you know, a Friday evening for a family to, you know, do something special or something like that. So those intangibles could kind of stretch the dollars of the Human Services Department. Now, in Oregon, our Department of Human Services speaks about an integrated services delivery system. And while that's still being fleshed out today, and there's different understandings of what that is, let me try to present the picture. Somebody comes in for aid. They qualify for aid. Okay? But the services are kept together in such a way that a person's entire need for assistance is addressed in a concerted manner. For instance, somebody might come in wanting a TANF grant or food stamps, but the integrated system notices that they also may have a domestic violence problem or a drug and alcohol problem or something else. So you're trying to address the whole person. Well, if you're trying to address the whole person, why not add to it a component, a resource that they may already have, which is an affiliation with a community-based organization that might be able to partner with the state, or a faith-based organization that might be able to partner with the state to address the whole person. That person brings that as a strength when they walk through the door of DHS. So you take stock of everything. Now, the next point I want to make is very important. A person goes in to the office only after they have already qualified for the TANF grant or whatever service it is that they've gone in for, would the next phase begin. And the next phase begins with some questions that I've got in the bottom of the second page of my document for you. The questions would, and I'm not saying these are the exact questions, but they'd center around the idea of whether first they'd be willing to answer a few questions. And if they don't want to answer questions, they don't have to, because they've already qualified for the grant. But if they would answer a few questions, the first one would be, do you, as a person coming through the door, have an affiliation with a faith-based or a community-based organization that might help you as you're trying to get out of this situation that you're in, that has brought you through the door to get this welfare grant or these food stamps or whatever? And if they say, yeah, I'm a member of it, then a second question would you be interested in utilizing that organization? Now, you can say no at any point, and it's important you understand that there can't be any coercion, because that would begin to violate, again, the church-state separation doctrine, at least if it was a faith-based organization rather than a community-based organization. It could be a CBO at that point. Anyway, you ask these questions. Would you be willing to contact somebody over there, or would you be willing to have us contact somebody over there, and would they be willing to be a partner with us? Now, if they are willing to be a partner, then it becomes interesting what would happen at that point, because I'm convinced of this. The state talks one language, and the faith community talks a different language. They have a whole different culture. You know what I'm saying? And they have to learn one another's languages. And even a community-based organization often talks a different language than a state organization. So we have to get people talking the same language so that they can kind of integrate with one another back and forth. Now, moving away from that paper to the actual, this is a draft copy of the Act. The Act itself would establish a pilot program in which DHS would just try to implement this concept. Okay? You can read all the whereases that are there, but the idea is that, you know, sometime on or before the 1st of January of 2004, the department would establish a pilot program in at least one service area somewhere just to test this concept, because it's not been tested anywhere in the country as far as I know. There are similarities to a program in Texas, but there's often more coercion in some of those programs than I'm comfortable with. There can't be any coercion whatsoever, because any kind of coercion would violate this very delicate balance of separation of church and state. The purpose of the program is to include faith-based and community-based organizations in an integrated effort to assist human services clients who may be affiliated with some organization. And I return to the idea that, yes, in Oregon that may be only 25% of the population, but if you were able to enhance the services even to 25% of the client load that's out there, you're going to benefit a lot of people. How many people are, and this might be a good question to ask Ramona when she comes up, but how many people at any one time are on food stamps? If we enhance the services even to 25% of people on food stamps, we'd be enhancing services to a lot of people. How many people are on welfare? If we were enhancing the services even to 5,000 out of the 20,000 or whatever, we would be enhancing services to a lot of people. And it could also be senior, disabled services, all kinds of things. So the department needs to develop a procedure so that their staff knows how to communicate with faith-based and community-based organizations, and community-based organizations know how to communicate with DHS. That's what this is about. And you move beyond that, it just becomes a matter of, you know, setting up a pilot to test this out. My thought would be, if you picked an office, a local, let's call it a welfare office, okay, but it's an integrated office, and it's in a community. Let's pick a community, any community. All right, the city of Bend has a welfare office, okay? If in the city of Bend, as an example, you would throw out a letter to 100 synagogues, churches, mosques, community-based organizations, and that letter from DHS just said, hey, we would like you to know that if you have somebody in your constituency that comes into our office to get help, we might like to contact you and see if you would be able to provide some tangible supports for those people. So a letter would go out. The churches, synagogues, community-based organizations would then know, hey, DHS wants to work with us. and they would kind of gear up and be ready. That's if I were sitting as a pastor somewhere, I'd be kind of gearing up and saying, well, you know, I don't know if anybody in my congregation's on welfare or getting food stamps, but if they do, I'd sure like to help them out, and we kind of gear up. So that's the first step. After that, they start interviewing people. The church, the synagogue, the community-based organization won't be surprised if at some point they get a phone call. It says, remember the letter we got? Well, one of your members came in. They want to give some services. We'd like to talk to you, but you have to go through a little bit of training first. It has to do with confidentiality, because there could be nothing worse than running a program where some member of a community, make it a Rotary Club. They belong to a Rotary Club, and all of a sudden everybody in the Rotary Club knows they're getting a welfare checker. You know, you can't do that. So there has to be some real confidentiality built into this whole thing. But it's a concept that I think is worth trying. And that's what I brought the bill forward for, and I'm glad that I've had a chance to explain it more than I usually have. I can't get that much time. I mean, Senator Fisher signed my bill, and several of you have signed my bill, but you usually don't have time to sit around for 20 minutes and allow me to describe what's been banging around in my head all this time. That's what I want to do with the bill.
Good. We have a couple of people giving testimony, and we will start.
Yeah. And I just want to say that I specifically did two things. I sent an email to everybody that was on any work group that I've been involved in the past to say that today we were going to describe it, but I asked people not to necessarily come today to testify, because I'd rather have the real bill in front of us when we start testifying.
Well, let's hear briefly from the people who aren't here. Okay, so we'll keep it.
We got another amendment coming up.
Well, it's actually a whole new bill.
Yeah.
Actually, Senator Minnis doesn't know this, but he helped me, because he went to rules with a need for a new bill, and I don't think I'd gotten mine if there hadn't been two of us at the same time. Bluntly, the relating clause says relating to faith-based organizations, and I said to myself, holy smoke, this is supposed to be faith-based and community-based, and none of the words relating to community-based could be added to this bill with the relating clause. It's not a mistake that's not been made before. When George Bush set up his office, it was originally an office of faith-based initiatives. Didn't take long for them to say, wait a minute, it should be called an office of faith-based and community initiatives. And that's exactly what we're doing here. But the relating clause required that we write a whole new bill. So that's not in front of us yet.
Okay, good. Ramon. So you're partly responsible for this. Remember that. Yes.
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Ramona Rademacher. I'm a policy advisor with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to just reinforce the fact that we have been in conversations with Senator Shields about this bill, and we are supportive of the concept behind this proposal. The bill that he has been discussing will create a pilot program to coordinate service delivery for individuals who are being served both by the Department of Human Services and who have an existing affiliation with either a faith or community-based organization or program. While our department is often able to provide the tangible services like information referral, skill development, financial resources, oftentimes other organizations are better equipped and have more history in providing the intangibles that Senator Shields referred to, such as participating as mentors, as role models, and providing personal and emotional support to help individuals to meet their goals. We believe that working in partnership with faith and community-based organizations will increase the likelihood that our clients are able to become healthy, independent, and safe, which is the mission of our department, and welcome the opportunity to see if this pilot program works. The department is fully in support of coordination of services at the local level. In fact, we have existing integrated services teams all over the state operating. The one thing we don't usually do, however, is ask the client who they would like to have involved to provide support to them and on a voluntary basis. And so that's really what's new about this concept, is instead of the caseworkers or the counselors deciding who should be present at the integrated services team, it gives the opportunity to the consumer to say, I would like an individual from a faith or community-based organization to participate as well. As I said before, the department has met with the authors of this bill and discussed several proposed amendments. We are in support of the bill with the amendments, not of the existing 789. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. If you have any questions about the department's view.
Have you discussed possible fiscal impacts?
We have talked about them, and while we haven't priced this out, as I said before, this is not a practice that's different than how we prefer to do business anyway. Essentially, it's inviting another player to the table, which would not significantly increase costs.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Stark.
Thank you. Are you aware of the initiative that's going on in Washington County called Visions West?
No, I'm not.
They've have a program of almost 2 years duration in which the county has been working with faith community and community organizations pretty much in this same way as I think we're proposing here. They have at the county level, under the executive county executive officer, an individual by the name of Don Boone, who's hired specifically for the purpose of outreach to the faith community. They've been meeting as many as 200 people in meetings. Don Boone himself has appeared before our congregation, our church, to present and invite participation. So I think you may already have a demonstration project well underway. Tom Bryan, who initiated this, has gotten national recognition for doing it. And I suggest as we go forward with this bill that we actually invite Don Boone and maybe even the county executive to come down and testify to the bill.
Yes, Senator.
Yeah, Senator Morris said, Don Boone and I have actually had a lengthy conversation about this already, and I did invite him to come when we had the actual hearing on the bill.
Okay.
What's fascinating, I just want to throw this at you, Don is a county administrator who had not, up until 2 years ago, as Senator Starr just mentioned, up until 2 years ago, he hadn't had a lot of contact with the faith community in Washington County. But when the county chair came up with the idea and Don started working on it, he said that literally he caught the idea of how far he could stretch human services in Washington County with this, and he has met with fully two-thirds of the churches and other faith-based organizations in Washington County in the last 2 years. That's a couple hundred churches. And so naturally he's been at your church. He's just gone around to them all talking about it because it really does stretch the state's and the county's human services effort. So Don Boone will be here along with several others whenever we have the hearing in the middle.
Okay. Thank you.
I had a question.
Yes.
Does the Department of Human Resources, did they bring in the business community?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, in certain circumstances, yes, we do, especially around self-sufficiency goals and finding people employment. Mm-hmm. We have developed partnerships of a variety of different types with business community.
And I think, Mr. Chairman, that really underscores, I think, what the idea is here, in the sense that, you know, I know we've got the ACLU and Andrea Meyer, who's a frequent visitor to the Judiciary Committee, present here today, and I'm sure she'll have instruction and words for us and admonitions, perhaps. I don't know, not to be presumptuous, but I think the idea, as I wrote here, is not to blend together the functions of the government and the church per se, but rather to coordinate existing resources. so that the community might be better enhanced by the functions of both. And I'll give you an example of what the Senate Judiciary Committee discovered during the course of the interim with respect specific to mental health issues and persons within jails. We found, and it's been demonstrated nationally, that there are two fundamental things necessary for the success of mental health patients, and it correlates with persons coming out of prison, and that is housing and employment. Now, if the government never talks to the business community about how you can break down some of the paradigms and the walls that separate persons with felony convictions and their access to employment, if you never meet with those people and talk to them about what you're trying to do and how persons coming out of prisons might actually function in employment in the employer community, then you continue to have a separation there. You're never going to get persons, again, coming out of prison in appropriate employment that will help them become self-sufficient. The same is true with persons with mental illnesses. Both issues, housing and employment, are fundamentally important. And so the stability of these very vulnerable people, and I include to some extent persons coming out of prison, because they have a lifestyle transition and change that they're having to go through. And if you just simply put those persons out in a community that's hostile or fragmented or broken up, then you leave them to their own devices to wander through the streets and to do what their nature might tend to want to do, and that is to throw their hands up and give up and go get drunk again and do what they might do and harm someone, like one of the recent rape suspects that I just put back in prison. And so I guess I'm saying all of this to say that our government and institutions of government, not just in Oregon but nationally, have for whatever reason been they've constructed a wall that I think is a false wall between the functions of the church and with the business community, because I think the business community needs to be brought into these discussions even to a greater degree and look at what's possible in terms of how you can serve your community, because it is service-oriented. We've done this historically with the multidisciplinary teams in child abuse intervention. We brought in law enforcement, we brought in the schools, we brought in prosecutors, social workers, the medical community, and it's fascinating what happens when people who have a certain perspective about whose job is what suddenly find that they're all part of the team. And those paradigms that they had and the biases that they had with respect to what their function is becomes different. All of a sudden they become people responsible for solving a problem, not persons who say, it's not my job. And I think to the extent that we increase this multidisciplinary team approach and include churches and or people of faith, etc., I think that that will enhance the service to the community. And it will, I think, help. I don't think it should cost you money. I actually think you could quantify a legitimate savings if there was an effort to do this. And I'm familiar, for instance, in the Portland metropolitan area with many churches who have outreach programs, and many of them exist side by side or within blocks of each other and perhaps don't even know that they exist. So, Senator Shields, my hat is off to you. I applaud what you're trying to do here. I don't think, in my opinion, it's at all offensive to where the government needs to go if we're really going to serve the needs of our constituent basis. I think that you have to let the government do what it does. It is what it is, and I agree with the ACLU to the extent that there has to be some level of separation. You don't compel monies from the government into the churches, et cetera. On the other hand, you have to let the church be the church. And you can't deny that they are who they are.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Senator Maness. In my former work in the department, I was a service integration manager and worked with a variety of different integrated teams, and it is very possible to have people pursuing different strategies towards the same goal. It's not does not necessarily have to be a blending of or a blurring of the lines between what the different parties do. We can all contribute in different ways to get to the same end.
Thank you. You mentioned the prison release. I set up a meeting in Lane County with Sponsors Incorporated, which is a halfway house for prisoners, and Scott Taylor from Corrections about the scope of the programs throughout the state. And the Oxford houses, I believe, are sponsored by a faith-based group out of Multnomah County, and the Oxford houses are halfway houses for people, and I don't think we do enough of that, and I think the faith-based group definitely has a role to play in this transition from prison back into the community. And so, good, thank you. We have two other individuals who wish to testify. Marcia Kelly, would you come up, please? And Andrea, would you please come up?
Again, my name is Marcia Kelly. I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. I won't run through the whole gamut of who we relate to. I was originally going to testify on 789, not being on Senator Shields' email list. I still do have some concerns about where the other bill is going. I do think it will have a fiscal impact on the Department of Human Services when you're talking about trainings. And coming from a rather eclectic church background. My mother was a Salvation Army officer before I was born. I attended the Methodist Church, and I'm active Episcopalian in a small congregation. And I've been involved with outreach and helping the needy and the poor from the beginning of my faith life, because that was sort of how my family lived. And I think that training representatives of faith-based and community organizations on the issues of poverty and its impact on individuals and families is probably something that you don't have to do. Most, I would contend, faith-based organizations and community organizations already know what poverty does and what impacts it has on families. And I think that if you approach community organizations who do social service and faith-based organizations who do social service, you will insult them with that. Our small Episcopal congregation of about 75 to 100 took on 9 families at Christmas time. One family had 10 kids. We do loose change for outreach every first Sunday. We do food bank Sunday on the second Sunday. We have within our congregation people who are provided rides by state agency heads to get someplace because they don't have a car and they've recently been cut off the Oregon Health Plan. So I think that there are some things that are not needed in this bill. I do think that the interaction to educate faith-based and community organizations about what services could be available on the state level, the TANF programs and the food banks and how you can interrelate those might be good, but I would then suggest that there is going to be a fiscal on this. I would like to suggest, however, that there are solutions, and one of those solutions is to look at how we give away money in our exclusions, deductions, and credits, and take a look at the tax expenditure books, and then maybe we can find some money for this new pilot program. And I would encourage the pilot program not to be necessarily just in a large metropolitan area, but maybe in a sort of more mid-sized, to see how it fits before you put it, if you do this pilot program, out to the whole state. Don't make it in such a small community that the privacy issues are more of a problem until you get the kinks worked out. And be sort of careful about what you do with the national model. I met a woman who works for the faith-based initiative office on a trip down the Willamette River and she was out in Oregon. She comes out to Oregon about once every 6 weeks. She's working with churches to help them on the importance of marriage. And I would contend that churches already have that effort going and that spending federal dollars on that is not what we would want to see our Oregon dollars spent on.
Thank you. Andrea.
So Chairman, as members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the... Oh, I'm so sorry. That was this morning when I didn't get a chance to testify. Chair Morissette, my apologies, and members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU. Actually, all I want to do today is ask Senator Shields to please add us to your email list so that I or a representative of the ACLU can play a role in this, both to address Article 1, Section 5, as well as the privacy issues.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I would like to say, and I know this ends up on the Internet and other places, we try to do an email thing, but I've never been very good at keeping that. And so not only both of you, but I would like anybody that's interested to contact my office and to get added to the email list. I can only apologize for not having as comprehensive a list, and we tried to get something out. As you know, Senator Morissette, we decided to go ahead and take the space that we had in the schedule and put it on the calendar now. Had I had more time, I probably would have remembered to get a hold of more organizations.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. I have my card for you today, Senator Shields. So.
My ally is right behind you there.
Okay. I'll get it. Thank you.
Okay, Chair. No others. Yes, Senator Menace.
Andrea.
Oh.
You can't escape.
I just can't let you go here.
Can I testify about Senate Bill 100?
Since you are a thing, no, you cannot. Well, actually, you can, since it is chairman, but it may not be relevant. With respect to separation of church doctrine issues and such, could you perhaps put together or prepare a list of documents or references, cases that are relevant to this issue so that the committee might be up to speed on?
Chair Mars, Senator Miz, are you talking about Oregon case laws under Article 1, Section 8? Or the whole world out there.
I'm talking about seminal cases in terms of federal cases and state cases here. We're probably all familiar with State v. Henry and some other issues relevant to free speech, but on the issue of church and state issue, how far can the government go in terms of interrelating its...
Well, Chair Morris, Senator Miz, there's not an extensive case law out there on Article 1, Sections 5. There's a bit more on Sections 2 and 3, which are not interfering with the person's right to raise and practice in their faith. Actually, Oregon has seven sections of Article 1 that relate to religious freedoms. So I'm happy that it's pretty brief and it's in the ORSs. You can, I'm happy to put it together, but...
Mr. Chairman, I was assuming, Andrea, that there were perhaps some writings on this issue.
Chair Morris, Senator Miz, I don't believe this particular issue has come up before the Oregon courts. I'm not familiar with any case specific to charitable.
Well, Mr. Chairman, perhaps I can ask differently. Does the ACLU have an opinion? And if so, is the opinion written? And if you could...
Chair Morissette, Senator Miss, no, we don't generally create legal opinions in terms of the Oregon ACLU. I'm certainly happy to ask my national, who's looked at the President Bush's proposal and has certainly done a lot on that, if they have any summary of the federal cases that give sort of a understanding of the context on the federal level. Of course,
perhaps, Mr. Chairman, Andrew, if you could, if the ACLU has ever filed any amicus briefs or other kinds of briefs on similar issues in federal court or state court, if you could give us the addresses or the copies of those documents so that the Chair of the Judiciary Committee can read through those and have some better understanding of the ACLU's position on church-state relationships.
Aren't you glad you came in?
Chair Morris, I just, so that I get you what you want, when you talk about the amicus at the ACLU, are you speaking of the ACLU of Oregon, the ACLU nationally? Because I can only anticipate that it would be such a
huge volume.
And I wouldn't be able to put my hands on it readily.
Just
for
the
you.
Seminal documents, the seminal cases that you're dealing with on the church-state issue.
And are you more interested in the court's decisions or our arguments and analysis?
Seminal decisions by the courts and then also your analysis would be helpful.
And when you come back in 2 weeks, report, please.
It was brief.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might indicate at this point, and I think it's relevant to do so, and Senator Menace would be interested. Five of the six of us who were senators in the last session actually signed a letter asking the Oregon Law Commission to look into issues of separation of church and state, and I think that's in progress. There's a professor over at Willamette University that was contracted by the Oregon Law Commission to do some research in that arena. And I've talked to Steve and asked him to give his input into this process. He, at least, was on my email list. My apologies that I failed to do so with others. So he would be a real resource for us. They have been looking at this issue, and I think that might help. Also, I wanted to point out our first witness here just made the comment that you think that churches really don't need to be filled in on poverty. And I thought I made the same point that you made with some folks, because my church has given away 100,000 meals, or at least the church I used to pastor and had a shelter for homeless people. Mm-hmm. But they stopped me dead in my tracks and said, well, you know, there's a lot of middle-class churches and synagogues around here that really could use some education on the effects of poverty, that live in a different world than your church and my church. And that was the response that I got. So that's why in Section 1, there's a 3C there. And I'm glad to eliminate it. It depends on what the committee wants to do. But if you look at 1, 3C, that's where it talks about in the bill that will be coming out next week or whenever it gets its first reading. It just talked, and this was actually language from DHS, where they talk about training representatives of faith-based and community organizations on the issues of poverty and its impact on individuals and families. And I at first was insulted by that. I know this subject, but maybe everybody doesn't.
I would really hesitate to put any sort of label on any sort of church, whether it's you're perceiving that middle-class churches are different than my little Episcopal church. I would not, you know, we could have a human rights discussion after an economic development discussion after virtually any Sunday service.
Yeah.
So.
It is my goal to end this meeting at 2:30, but I'll...
Chair, I just... wanting to have some questions asked, and I signed on to this primarily because I want to learn more about it. I want to see it discussed a little bit at this level. But if there are monies and stuff transacted, how would you propose to have the state do any type of auditing and things like that? Would a church be required to keep a totally separate account and so forth on all these things? I do not have any desire to see the state all of a sudden auditing churches and finding out, going through all their books and that kind of thing.
Okay. Senator Shields first.
I just want to respond that, in fact, the bill itself makes it clear, I think somewhere in here, that the state handles the money. They handle the welfare grant, whatever. All that faith-based and community organizations do is the intangible stuff, the mentoring, the networking, the encouraging. There's no money transaction. That's the difference between this and some of the other faith-based initiatives. And
that's already not so. State ministers a food bank program, and our church receives thousands of pounds of food from the food bank and distributes that to families in the community. So we're involved in a different level than just... But I think that as far as dollars, I think that's probably a good distinction, perhaps. But on the other hand, when a church is providing drug and alcohol abuse treatment programs, they, in fact, can and do receive assistance from...
If there are existing programs, however, that's beyond this bill.
Okay.
That's a different arena. That's something that's been going on, if it has. If somebody's getting money from the government to do commodities like food banks, that's separate. That existed before this bill. It has nothing to do with this bill.
Senator Mann.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you might actually find it's a little bit different, too. You might find, like, my church is in the process of raising $6 million, most of which is going to go into the community in some form or another, or to other churches locally and so on and so forth. And I happen to go to a very large church. They're capable of doing that kind of thing. So it may actually be that the money flows from the churches to the community as opposed to the government to the churches. And so, you know, I agree with Senator Fisher. The last thing I'd want to do is have government money flowing to the churches and then have the churches have to sit there and account for it and have some onerous, you know, responsibility or duty to report back to the government. I think the church, that's why I said let the church be the church. I don't think the church would respond well to that. I agree with Senator Starr, though, where you do have very specialized programs with drug and alcohol treatment, federal money flowing into the programs. There are probably some other requirements need to be met. And so,
well, and there are numerous faith-based communities already in existence. Catholic Community Services in Lane County distributes food through the food bank. St. Vincent and Paul has numerous programs for which they get many dollars from the federal government. And there is a firewall that exists. But and then there's the mission in Eugene that provides services, but they do cross the line in the sense that they have expectations, but that's recognized. But I you know, faith-based is nothing new, and this is just a new kind of configuration of it, and I think it's a good idea. So with that, I'm going to end the meeting. We're adjourned.
Well, you're ended by 2:33.
Can we go to 3?
No.
We like to talk.
Andrea.
Mr.